And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments...
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Imago Theater's production of Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater in Portland. The chamber art musical The Rape of Lucrece is an intense, intimate production featuring a combination of spoken word and song. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 11 o'clock at KBOO Portland, and it's time for the Recovery Zone. Today, Stephanie Potter welcomes historian Ray Raphael and Community Rights U.S. founding director Paul Cienfuegos.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today, we'll be talking to historian Ray Raphael of Humboldt County, California, who has written over 20 books, mostly based on real people telling their own stories. His early books dealt with topical and regional matters, including local history, the timber wars, and marijuana cultivation. And in the early 1990s, while preparing a curriculum for his United States history courses, he became fascinated by the history of the common people during the American Revolution. And since then, his focus has been on the revolution and the nation's founding. His books expose the messy reality behind the creation of our national documents, and they reveal an alternative narrative to the stories of heroic individualism that were usually taught in school and that was fostered by an emerging nationalism in the 19th century. Ultimately, his work has profound implications for us as citizens, as we the people, for recognizing our own political authority, and he's going to be talking a lot about that. Howard Zinn inaugurated the People's History series with Raphael's A People's History of the American Revolution, which was written in 2001. A few of his more recent books are President, How and Why the Founders Created a Chief Executive, Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right, The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began, and Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past. And he's just sort of an expert on all of this at this point. Raphael has also developed a series of interactive lesson plans for the Constitutional Source Project. And it's a thing where students participate in historical decision-making to help them prepare for civic life. So we have Ray on the phone right now to discuss his research and its implications. And we're also here in the studio with me is Community Rights U.S. Founding Director Paul Cienfuegos, who actually turned me on to Ray and is here to ask a lot of questions, too, so we can get the story. So, Ray, you're there, right?
I am here. Yes, I Great. Am. I'm in California right now, and you're in Oregon, so hi.
Yeah, hi. Raining here. So
I wish it were raining more here. But
I know. It's a crazy world, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I know that you came out from New York to... In the 60s, you went to Reed. You volunteered in the South with voter registration drives and with the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and you also opposed the war in Vietnam. And eventually, you found yourself as part of the Back to Land movement in Humboldt County. What basically got you into this writing that you're doing and this focus on oral histories?
Well, there's two elements to that. Getting into writing, when I actually was part of the Back to the Land movement, and I wasn't one of these people in school who always wanted to be a writer and then just had to, you know, dream up a book to write. I was part of the Back to the Land movement, and when I arrived, being a native of New York City and arriving within sight of the Pacific Ocean in this amazing brushland, dramatic cliffs and everything, I was just awestruck and said, "What is going on here? You know, what's life been like here for while I was in New York City and all the preceding years before that? And what's life been like not only for human history but before human history and the Native people and then even before that?" And so I wrote this book called An Everyday History of Somewhere. And my idea then was to just get right down to the bottom of everything and just, you know, what are people's real life experiences? I talked to a lot of old timers. I studied with a Native American who gave me a lot of Native American culture. And then before that, you know, I just have to go to archives. And then I started imagining not only life for humans, but like, what about other living things? How has human presence affected deer? What about, like, we grow potatoes? Well, potatoes aren't native to there. So, you know, when do they come in? You just every conceivable question, what about the salmon and so on? So that was a delightful book, and it did very well, and it won the Commonwealth Club Award for the Best Book of California. So suddenly I was a writer.
Great. And actually, it sounds like you're a guy with a lot of curiosity. And then you found yourself getting into, by the 90s, the revolution and the founding era. And what got you into all of that?
Yeah, well, when I did get into that, let me carry through on the thread of the kind of down-to-earth history, which I had been doing. I was talking with old-timers for other books, the regional books that I did, Tree Talk and Cash Crop. I would talk to all the people who were directly affected. In other words, it was always very grounded, people-based history. And I think I wanted, you know, how I got oriented that way, I think really was the Civil Rights Movement back in the 60s, and we always hear Martin Luther King, and he was a great man and everything, but I was part of SNCC, and there were so many amazing people on the ground, the SNCC field secretaries who would go out and risk their lives trying to get people onto what they call the plantations, because they really were still plantations, to get people to vote. And then the locals, like Fannie Lou Hamer, who we know about from the Mississippi Convention. You know, I was in her house before she was famous, and she's the most amazing person. And Amzie Moore, who's heard of him. He had been an activist for 20 years in his local town in Mississippi. So I just had this total idea that, you know, history is so much richer than the kind of the names that we think about. And so when I got into history, all my books have been basically grounded in this kind of like grassroots people, grassroots movement. And so when I started studying the American Revolution, and that was, I was trying to do a critical thinking program for high school on history, and I started with the revolution. And so anyway, and what did I start with? I started, well, how was that like for common people? And then that's what led to the People's History of the American Revolution. And once I had spent about 5 years studying that, I was so deeply entrenched in the late 18th century that I never fully escaped. So I'm only half here.
That's great. And Paul, you were going to have him talk.
Yeah. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Paul.
Pleasure to have you on the radio with us. I'm wondering if you could just do a spiel for a couple of minutes that kind of frames how we ended up in the transition between people as colonists who were begging the king for basic rights, to a place where we the people start seeing themselves as having their own authority. Kind of what that transition period looks like, early American Revolution, and then we'll ask you questions. But if you could just maybe speak for a couple of minutes about that transition period.
Yeah, and that's really the big question. I've given a lot of thought to that. When did we people really start moving from resistance to independence? Is that your kind of question?
Yes.
Right there?
Yeah.
And people start, a lot of people just group this whole revolutionary fervor and unrest into one generic time span. Basically starts in 1765 and then ends with independence in 1776, so about a decade. And they just kind of throw things around without any attention to the dynamic of what the escalation was, because in the 60s people were very concerned with taxation without representation. That's true, but they were also very loyal British subjects. And there's not a person in America, not a public figure in America, who came out and said it espoused independence at that moment during that in the tax, the resistance to the tax to the Stamp Act and the Townsend Act, and even as into the Boston Massacre and so on. Nobody was talking about independence. They were talking about the rights of British citizens, and they wanted to have the same rights as everybody else who is a British citizen and not be treated as, you know, as underlings. And, you know, so that was a grassroots, you know, I mean, that was a big political movement. Where it started moving towards independence is really Britain moved it towards independence by measures that took it out of the realm of just ordinary resistance. Ordinary. Nothing's ordinary when you're resisting to the level that they resisted. But it really escalated. We think of, and that really started with the Boston Tea Party, which was an act of a political theater, and, you know, the most dramatic act of political theater, and really the most influential act of political theater that we've ever had in terms of what happened. Okay, so they threw some tea overboard, we know that. Now, where it really started moving towards independence, and still nobody was talking about independence yet, nobody. And there was a lot of debate between what they call Whigs and Tories, which are kind of the names for political parties of Britain, but we kind of adopted them here. Whigs were the people who really wanted to fight for their independent, not independent, their rights as British subjects. And Tories were the people who leaned more towards the power of the king, kind of authoritative, and Parliament, you know, the British authority. And and they were, you know, they were more Whigs than Tories, but they were, it was kind of a viable debate. It was kind of like in Massachusetts, like in the town that I studied mostly, Worcester, they had three votes in a town meeting in the wake of the Tea Party, and all of these votes in the town meeting were decided by like five people, you know, like 65-60, that kind of thing, and then. What Britain did after the Tea Party, they passed these measures that they called the Coercive Acts, and later the Americans started calling them the Intolerable Acts. One was to shut down the Port of Boston, and that was pretty dramatic. But here comes the big one that we hardly ever hear. They revoked the charter for Massachusetts. And the people in Massachusetts had a great deal of say. They really were enfranchised. They would elect their representatives. Those representatives would choose the council, and the council had to approve all measures and all appointments, and they kind of ran a lot of the everyday government. They also met in their town meetings all the time, and they did anything they darn well wanted in their town meetings. They had a lot of control over everything. And those measures were revoked by the Massachusetts Government Act, and they said you can't meet in your town meetings except once a year, and anything you do has to be approved by, anything you even talk about has to be approved by the royal appointed governor. And then the council, which had formerly been elected, was going to be appointed by the crown. I mean, these intentionally, you know, basically they disenfranchised the people of Massachusetts, and that was the moment in which there was no longer a viable argument that that was a good thing for the people of Massachusetts. And suddenly, instead of having about a 55-45 split, you had more like a 90-10 split, and just a few people, you know, office holders and so on, who really benefited from the British. And that was the moment, and that's something that I think we forget, and it's a very key thing as we think of resistance today. When you're talking about, when you're talking about, you know, basically the dichotomy that we have today and these two political parties, it's very hard for the people, to unite and really get, you know, something done in, for the people with that kind of split. And you really have to get to this point where the people really are the people. And that's where community rights comes in, I think. I mean, community rights has to get beyond the divisions that these, you know, the kind of like the information divisions that we have and the yelling that we have, and down literally to the grassroots where people can come together with their own humanity and their own interests and the shared interests. And that's what they did in the revolution. And they did it through grassroots organizing. Oh my gosh, the Committees of Correspondence were with the most amazing grassroots network that you can imagine.
As you're speaking, I keep thinking about the recent stories coming out of Michigan over the last few years where the government keeps, the governor of Michigan keeps disenfranchising city councils or literally dissolving them and replacing them with emergency managers, and all of the state preemptive laws that are growing all over the country, not just from Republican legislatures, but also from Democrat-controlled state legislatures like here in Oregon. I assume that you see relevance in that connection.
Yeah. I mean, disenfranchisement was the key. That was the key. That was what set off the revolution. And by the way, I talk about Massachusetts, and that's where the revolution started. And the other colonies came in, in support of Massachusetts. They saw it could be done there. And so once things got to the point of warfare there, the other colonies joined in. I mean, they had their own resistance movement all along, but they didn't take that big step until disenfranchisement. That is the key. That is the key. As long as people have or feel that they have some power in their government, I have to rephrase that. It's not like that's all okay. You have to use that power somehow. But it's at the point where people have no power at all that things become, if no legal power, that they disenfranchise, they don't have the power of their vote. That's the point at which real revolutionary change has to happen, because if it doesn't happen, then we're just submitting to tyranny.
I'm going to interrupt right here just to say that you're tuned as a listener to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm Stephanie Potter here in the studio with Paul Cienfuegos, founding director of Community Rights U.S., and we're talking with historian Ray Raphael, who's speaking to us from Humboldt County, California. And I think it's really interesting that you're talking about the people being really united. And like a lot of what we're hearing now, just in everything, is how split America is. There's this tremendous split between the Republicans and the Democrats, between the urban and the rural. And
Greens, libertarians.
And how we get to a point, you're saying, where we start uniting again is when we're, it sounds like, desperate? I mean, something like that almost?
Well, that's what happened then. There's a lot of difference between then and now. I mean, the grassroots could be more thoroughly grassroots back then. There was less, the seat of authority was 3,000 miles away, for one thing. And then the communication really was, there was the press, and the press is, that was certainly a factor in terms of spreading news, but life was grassroots. I mean, you were dealing with, the politics was going on, kind of formally in town meetings and informally in all the taverns and blacksmith shops. I mean, I've written a lot about this blacksmith, Timothy Bigelow in Worcester, who was emerged as the leader of this movement, and he was a blacksmith, and he was you bring in your tools and they're getting forged and reshaped and everything, and people are kind of hanging around. It's kind of like almost like the barber shop like when we were in the South, and a lot of the local politics is actually happening in the black community. It's happening in the barber shops. And that's the way the blacksmiths were. So it was very people to people kind of thing, and so you had less kind of less barrage from media with that real human interaction. It was easier to forge a network of people who could actually take action.
So how do we end up at the point where, for example, in Springfield, Massachusetts, 3,000 people in August of 1774 closed the Hampshire County courts because they no longer respect the legitimacy of the courts, and the shutting down of county and local councils as well? What is that moment look like on the ground?
Well, that moment looks like it starts, people here, and this the press takes a role because the word spreads that they've been disenfranchised. So, so they, as luck would have it, well, it wasn't luck; it was a lot of hard work. After the Tea Party, the communities in throughout Massachusetts set up at these local committees of correspondence. And now, how this committee of correspondence work is very key, because you have, you know, like now we have political action groups, right? Well, those political action groups are independent groups that are kind of like, you know, they're private associations, and you'll have your right wing and your left wing political action groups. The committees of correspondence were different. Remember, New England had, throughout New England and Massachusetts, had a town meeting structure. Every town had a town meeting, and that meeting was the local governance of that town. They would appoint the Hogreaves and the fence viewers and the various officials that took care of, you know, they kind of looked after public life. And they would appoint a representative to the provincial assembly. And so the town meeting was key. And the idea of the committees of correspondence was because they had some of those in the 60s, but they were private organizations, 1760s. And they said, why don't we link these to local government? So these committees of correspondence were kind of a committee of the town meeting. And they were charged with paying close attention to these dramatic events that were happening and sort of advising, like, where do we go from here with that? So they were actually public bodies. They were public bodies appointed by the town meeting. And then, so then when things escalated to the, and that was just before the disenfranchisement. Then when people got disenfranchised, these committees of correspondence started saying, wow, we got to really do something big here. So they started having county conventions. So all the towns Springfield was part of Hampshire County, Worcester was part of Worcester County, and they would have county conventions where the people from the town committees of correspondence would come together and figure out what to do. Now, in each town, they call shire towns, there were county seats. The local courts were going to come to meet, and the local courts come to meet four times a year, quarterly. And the local courts were more than just, they were more than just trying the cases. They were also the kind of the farthest reach of British authority. They were kind of the local government. Like at the local courts, you'd have the Court of Common Pleas, which was the trial court, and the Court of General Sessions, which actually was kind of the local county-wide government. And so people decided, wait a second, these are the farthest reach of the royal authority. We are going to not let the new law take effect by basically shutting down that county government. It's the official British county government. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's county government, but it's the long arm of the British,
right?
That's doing there, and they're saying we are not going to accept anything from the Massachusetts Government Act. And so the people did this. And in the committees of correspondence, they did exactly what their name said. They corresponded. And how do you correspond then? Horseback. Boy, that's a big deal, you know. Horses. So horses are what made this this possible. You know, they're all riding all over, getting together, and then they come together, 3,000 people in Springfield. In Worcester, there were 4,622 people coming together. And these weren't just like, they weren't just casual gatherings in Worcester. They were the militia. They were 37 militia towns, militia units from 37 towns throughout Worcester County. Half the adult male population showed up from a rural county that sprawled all the way from Rhode Island on the south to New Hampshire on the north. And you know, it's just you can hardly believe it. Half of the people, adult males, show up in one day, and what they do is they say, we are going to unseat this official authority. And they do it. They do it in Springfield. They do it in Worcester and Bristol.
How did they do it?
The story I'd love you to talk about how is lining up the entire town in two rows and making them walk through the middle. These appointees.
We have different reports from the different, you know, all the different counties. We have sort of various levels of reporting. And like Worcester, Springfield, we have this one very detailed letter. in Worcester, we have a lot of information, one of which is one guy, when I say 4,622 militiamen, one of the participants went to all 37 towns and said, okay, how many people you got, you know? And they added them all up, and that's how many people there were. And so you have that 4,622, half the adult male population, and then you have two dozen court officials. And so how are so of course, the first thing they do is the people just take over the courthouse. That's no problem, you know, where the court is supposed to meet. And so, you know, that evening and that morning, they just take over the courthouse and barricade it up, and so the judges can't meet there. So the judges get together, and they meet in a tavern halfway down Main Street. And they're just kind of, they just have to wait there until the crowd determines its fate. So how are these people suddenly going to get and figure out what to do? Well, they appoint, this is so grassroots, they appoint their a representative from each of the 37 groups, militia units. Remember, these are militiamen. And remember, militias are public groups. Like people say now, the militia units, these right-wing organizations, there's no such thing as a private militia. Militias are the military embodiment of the people. That's the definition of a militia, embodiment of the people. They are part of the government. There's no militia that is not part of a government. Otherwise, you just have a bunch of armed people. And so, anyway, these 37 groups, they appoint their representatives, they get together, and they go meet with the people in the court, you know, huddle in Daniel Haywood's tavern. And they iron out a process about, like, basically it's what's the wording going to be for their recantations, you know, how are they going to word it? So they get a rough draft, and then what do? They send it back down to the 37 companies for the approval, you know, like, hey, you know, we can't sign off on this.
So just profoundly democratic.
Democratic.
And Ray, we have a whole bunch of questions still we want to ask you,
okay.
So it might make sense to shorten your answers, and we also want to bring in callers and not that many minutes from now.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry for that. I get so
okay.
carried away.
It's okay. It's
anyway,
totally fascinating.
Well, in short, they finally decide, here's what's going to do, and each of the officials, one by one, has to emerge from the tavern, put his hat in his hand, and walk the gauntlet between these people lined up on both sides of Main Street, reciting his recantation. And of course, there's no loud speakers, really, and no mic, you know. So he has to go through, recite it once and again, so over 30 times, he goes over about a third of a mile, he has to recite
so,
these.
So he's walking.
And it's happening everywhere. Let me just say, in Plymouth, people get so pumped up after doing this kind of takeover of the government that they go down to Plymouth Rock and they say, we're going to lift Plymouth Rock and bring it to the town square to show our power. And anyway, they couldn't do that. They could unseat the government, but they could not move Plymouth Rock. And that, in a nutshell, is the story of the revolution in Massachusetts. Once Massachusetts had done that, then the British had to, they can't just let that happen. So they arm, they get ready, they get ready to retaliate, and all winter they're preparing, and the people of Massachusetts are preparing. And 6 months later, Lexington and Concord, war has begun, and the other colonies join in. And so that is what happened. And it started with the committees of correspondence, grassroots organization, part of the town meeting structure.
And it was leaderless. It was collaborative. I mean, sometimes I'm even thinking this could be the Occupy movement if it could get just maybe a little more organized or something, you know, although that isn't happening at all anymore.
Well, and the problem is the Occupy movement was progressive as well. So, and this was people across the political spectrum.
Right,
and
it was everybody.
It's one of the things that I'm really excited about the community rights movement is that it's progressives and conservatives working together at the local level. I'm not really aware of other social movements where that's happening as effectively.
And that precisely is why I'm so excited about Paul's work, because, I mean, that is the key. You know, you have to get, you know, you have to, you, the people have to come together and see it's there in joint interests. And the increasing polarity that's being fed by social media, and, I mean, just exaggerated by social media, that you just have to break through that, because the strength of the Occupy movement, by the way, was its slogan. It was against the 1%, and that's what you have to do. You have to realize yes, you have to get people to realize that there's this veneer at the top that's running the show, and you have to unite people below that. If you could get the 99%, the 1% would be helpless. but it's how to get that, a lot better than this, a lot more unified than the split we have today.
Again, I want to let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland Community Radio. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I'm here with Community Rights U.S. founder Paul Cienfuegos to talk with historian and prolific author Ray Raphael. And he's setting the record straight on our history so that to help us make better decisions in the present. And Paul, you had another question?
Yeah, so I want to jump forward a little bit, Ray, and talk about the original Constitution, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union that was intended to be our long-term Constitution, but there ended up being quite a political coup against it after not that many years. And I'm just wondering whether you can, and again, we've got a bunch of questions and our time is limited, so if you can be somewhat brief in explaining, if that's even possible, that the transition between our first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, that empowered the states, not the feds, that didn't have standing courts, didn't have a Supreme Court, didn't have an executive branch, was much more democratic at the state and local level, and only 10 or 15 years later we end up with the Constitution that we have now that really flips where power resides and makes it possible for us to become an empire. And I'm wondering whether you've given much thought to what might have happened if the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, our original supposedly long-term Constitution, if it had been allowed to be that long-term Constitution, if there hadn't been a political coup against it, what might we look like as the United States of America?
Okay, yeah, I've not only given a lot of thought, but I've written books about this.
And great.
What happened is the thing about the Articles is it wasn't a government. There was no government.
There was no federal government.
There was no federal government.
But it was just states.
It was NATO. It was NATO. It was not a government. It was the European Union. It was a confederation. Congress could pass no laws. So usually a government passes laws. Congress could pass no laws.
Well, the government was the states, and they met in Congress to discuss. The states met together.
People met in Congress. Congress was a Congress. It was like the European Union. You know?
Right.
Congress could raise no money. So you have a group that can't raise money and can't pass laws. Now, that's not a government. So what happened is the only way they could get money is they could requisition the states. How do you requisition the states? Okay, so how you requisition is you say, okay, we need so much. So the people in Congress would kind of quibble and argue about, well, how much money should we give? You know, so like in 1783, the North said, to figure it out how much money you should give, we should count slaves. You know, so the South would have to pay for its slaves because they're productive labor in the North, you know. And they had a big quarrel about that, and they figured, okay, they couldn't, you know, the North said count the slaves, and the South said don't count the slaves because they're only slaves. And so they settled on this thing, okay, well, we will charge the government, the states, for 3/5 of the slaves, okay? And then, interestingly enough, 4 years later, when we're talking about representation, you know, you ever wonder why that 3/5 clause gets in? Suddenly the South says count them, and the North says don't count them. They totally reverse their situation, thing, and they sell. The only thing they can agree on is the same fraction for a compromise, 3/5. What I'm getting at is that there was no way for the federal government to raise money. So in the 6 months before the Constitutional Convention met in May of 1787, the federal government received a grand total of $663 to run the government from the states. The states, they paid their money during the war, and then gradually they just stopped paying. And the drawback to the Articles of Confederation, why it came to that, is because they wanted to amend it to say, okay, let's give the federal government the power to raise some money. like to levy an impost tax. That would be the main way that they could raise money. But the articles required unanimity for any amendment, and there was always one state that wasn't it for it. It wouldn't agree. First, it was Rhode Island because they had their own state impost tax, and it was New York because they didn't. So they couldn't amend it. So the weakness of the articles was that it was rigid. And the reason it could not be perpetual is because they demanded unanimity for so when you say what might have happened, it couldn't have lasted. It just was not possible. What could have happened is perhaps if they made the articles a little more fluid and didn't require unanimity, maybe that could have emerged into a more truly decentralized government. But as it was, that's what set the stage for the people who made the Constitution. And they did, when they thought of federal powers, they said, we have to do this pretty dramatically. And they greatly, in the government they created an executive branch. They created, they had to create a national judiciary, because now you could pass laws. If Congress has no laws, there's going to be no judiciary, nothing to adjudicate.
But there was also a real interest among some of part of this, of these founders, for global empire, to replicate global empire in what was now the United States, right? You haven't mentioned that.
This is
the empire in the sense of, like, there's the British Empire, or, you know.
As opposed to local.
They were obsessed with Europe. And they wanted to do the nation, you know, they wanted to be the real nation. And of course, as they did this, they were very much looking westward. You know, I think that's what you have in mind by empire. They were very much thinking, yes, this, you know, look at the vast interior and blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, they were interested in creating a strong national, you know, you can call it nation or empire or whatever, but yeah. There was in basically power over the North American continent.
And so we end up with a constitution that I believe it was Thomas Jefferson who said that each generation should write their own constitution, or at least update the existing constitution. And instead, we've ended up with this thing that's pretty frozen in time, and the founding fathers are now treated as gods. It's really profoundly undemocratic, is it not?
Yeah, but I don't think it's as frozen as time as you think, because actually there's a big difference when you think about the requirement for amendments going from unanimous, all 13, all the way down to 9 out of 13. And they debated that a lot. Should it be 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12? And they settled at 9. And when you think of some of the amendments that have been very, very significant, you know, most, of course, of the Civil Rights, you know, the Civil War amendments, you know, 13, 14, and 15, there's been, you know, women's right to vote. I mean, you know, there have been very significant amendments and very significant changes. And the other thing you have to realize is that the founders, they did not think that they were going to be creating this, the Constitution, and everybody was going to be then after doing exactly what they said. That wasn't the idea. They were trying to create a structure of government by under which you could have representative, I'm going to call it a republic. They did not believe in democracy. They believed in republic. That's a big difference.
Sure.
And actually, if you want to really follow that through, go to Consource, 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 and go to lesson plans and my lessons on the Constitution, and I have one there called The Republic or Democracy. And what it was is, back to New England, in those times, a lot of places gave the local towns instructed their representatives to vote this way or that. They gave instructions. And so, and in a lot of the state rights, the state declarations of rights that the Bill of Rights was based on, in the what became the First Amendment, they say the right of the people to assemble and petition their government, and they have the word instruct there, the right of the people to instruct their representatives, okay? And so James Madison struck out the word instruct when he revised it to the Bill of Rights. And so they had a debate in Congress, and it was the longest debate of the federal government built during the Bill of Rights debates in the first federal Congress. And they had a long debate about whether people should have the right to instruct their representatives or not. And it's fascinating. And anyway, look that up, Republican Democracy.
I mean, really,
you decided no.
You're talking about really the difference between, in a republic, we depend on our representatives. And
that's right.
But we are, according to our state and federal constitutions, the sovereign people with the government required to serve us as our subordinates. So there is this very uncomfortable disparity between those two logics.
Yeah, well, but the idea is, I see both sides of that. I mean, the question is, how do you determine what the people want, right? And what they did, they say, okay, here's how we will keep the government responsive. We will elect the House of Representatives, which is supposedly the most powerful of the bodies, every 2 years. And most powerful, I mean, because that is the people. Now, the problem is that they didn't really write that in, that it was most powerful, because actually the Senate has more things to do than the House does. But they said, for instance, all money issues have to start in the House. Well, that's proved meaningless, because it has to be approved by both, the House and the Senate. But it's a difficult dialectic between those two things. Do the people decide, or do their representatives decide? And what the compromise they came to is, okay, the people can turn out their representatives every 2 years.
And then there's also the state and local ballot initiatives that the populists fought for in the late 1800s and succeeded at bringing to more than half the states, which really, is not a republic, right? Because that's direct rule by the people.
That is direct rule by the people, exactly. And that's so as you get down to the local level, it gets more possible to actually determine what the people want. Who are the people and what do they want? And the ballot initiatives are huge in that. And some people, for better and worse. I mean, we have in California, we're living with Prop 13 and all the destruction that has created in terms of, destruction, inequalities, power of the corporation. You talk about power of corporations.
Right.
I mean, Prop 13, for people who don't know, it basically restricted the property tax to 1.5% of the value, and that would change any time the property changed hands. So people, when they sell houses, you can raise the taxes hugely. But corporations, since corporations never die, we have corporations paying property taxes at the 1980 level. So
right.
In California, the corporations are not doing anything to support the schools or anything like
I just want to ask one more question, then we're going to open it up and see if there are any call-in questions. So I look at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, over these last few months, and the director, Ajit Pai, who's a Comcast corporate executive who's now running the FCC, has utterly ignored the millions of people saying we want net neutrality. And I look at the FCC and the EPA and the Department of Energy and all these other regulatory agencies at the state and federal level as fundamentally anti-democratic, because they don't take their authority from the public. They're not accountable to the public. And you look at the activism that's going on all of these crises today, and boy, do we have a lot of crises around the country these days, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. And I think our activism seems so conventional. We keep begging the FCC to give us net neutrality. And I look back at your stories about the public shutting down unresponsive and unaccountable government bodies. And I keep thinking, why are we the people not shutting down physically through mass civil disobedience, the FCC, when it's not following the will of the people and other agencies, right? The USDA forcing GMOs on people when they don't want them, et cetera, et cetera. What would that look like if we were understanding our power as we the people?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I'm going to use the FCC as an example, because I think when you get to like the GMO thing, if you do the GMOs, you're going to have more, the will of the people is going to be a little bit more harder to determine. You're probably going to have 60-40 splits on that kind of thing. But But what I like is your example of net neutrality, because probably, what are the polls? 80-85% of the people?
Overwhelming, you
know, yeah. Oh, so overwhelming. I mean that's the level at which we have unity, the kind of unity that they had in Massachusetts in 1774.
So what would you suggest? What would a sovereign people be doing right now if we understood our political power?
If people cared enough about net neutrality, you know,
they do care, but they don't understand where their power resides.
I know, but we don't care. I mean, the thing is, like, the people there, they cared enough to leave their crops and leave their and all go to one place and so on. And in a sense, you know, like net neutrality, it affects everybody. But there's so many things, you know, we're being barraged in so many ways. I mean, how many people are actually going to go down and shut down the FCC?
Well, no one's going to if the advocacy groups aren't pushing us to. They're just pushing us to sign online petitions. So to me, that's where the fault lies, is the advocacy groups don't understand how to mobilize people properly. But we have a caller on the line.
Yeah, actually, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, and I'm Stephanie Potter here in the studio with Paul Cienfuegos, founding director of Community Rights U.S. We're talking with historian Ray Raphael, speaking to us from Humboldt County. And you can call in with your questions, 503-231-8187. And Tim is on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Tim.
You guys doing a great job. I just wanted to call it to bring your attention to the fact that right now there's a proposal in Congress that would put us in jail or fine us if we call for a boycott of Israel. That is being co-sponsored by our champion of liberty, Senator Ron Wyden.
Of Oregon,
yes. And I think if that passes, not only is it's a broach of free speech here, but it sets a precedent. Once it makes it illegal for us to criticize Israel, who's next and what's next? Once the established principle is there, we've just about lost our rights to free speech. And so I think callers should be very aware of that. Should call
Ray,
him.
Ray, what are your thoughts on that?
I was unaware of that. If that representation is correct,
it is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm going to go and Google it after we get off the phone. I'll figure it. I'll pay attention to it.
It's pretty fascinating. Yeah. It's just the automatic lockstep towards supporting Israel in our House and Senate.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Yeah. How can we be neutral? A neutral broker of peace.
You know, sometimes I just think it's so many different things. There's almost a sense of overwhelm. But we have Chris on the line. Chris?
Good morning, everybody. My comments, basically? Yeah. Is that what you're waiting for?
Yeah.
Well, I just moved from Hawaii, where I spent the last 53 years. Now, Hawaii supposedly has been being run by a bunch of Democrats for the last 60 years. Well, those Democrats are so pro corporate state, and they're bought and sold for. Getting to the point of this gentleman's discussion, you know, the point is, you guys are trying to work within a totally corrupt and broken system. You're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
That's certainly not what the community rights movement is doing. It's not working within the system. It's challenging these structures of law that make real democracy impossible.
And then, you know, well, real democracy. I mean, I've been trying to play with that too for as long as I've been, since I turned 18, and that's a broken system too.
Well, it's democracy is not a system, it's rule by the people is the literal translation.
You're mincing words. It's not a system. I mean, it's a system where
it's a concept.
We're pretending to work within, right? We're pretending to work within, but it's not even about that. It's about capitalism, right? I mean, that's who's really running the show.
Ray, talk, and then we have another caller.
And then we have the quantitative.
Caller? We need to give Ray an opportunity to respond, and then we have another caller.
Okay.
I just want to say that's what we're all trying to get at. We all agree that there's We do not have a functioning democracy that's working for the people. We're all agreed with that. The question is, what do we do tactically to try to establish, get closer to that? And I think Paul's point is we have to move past the, like, petition, you know, plead. It has to go past that.
And it sounds like we also have to get incredibly united. Elliot, you're on the phone?
Yes.
What would you like
to
say?
I'd like to say that this is one of the greatest programs I've heard on KBOO in a long time, because it's pointing out that there was a time in the past when apparently we were able collectively to have great radical reform, and people are wondering, with all three branches of government controlled by the right wing, people are wondering how we can get back, if not to 1776, at least to 1965. And we don't really know how to do that.
Ray?
Yeah, well, you know, if we could, oh, yeah, let's just do that, that would be great. That's very difficult. And basically, it has to start at the grassroots level. That's the whole point of this show, that's the point of Paul's work. And that's what I think I confirm in my books, is that it has to be at the grassroots level, and it has to be at the level where it's not just sort of one part of the grassroots yelling at the other part of the grassroots.
Right.
So one thing, as progressives, I assume a lot of your listeners are progressive, that you know, yelling things that match your party line is not going to get you anywhere. You know, it's not that, and you know, holding firm on the dreamers, you know, and shutting down the government because otherwise, you know, we're all lost or something. It's a yelling. You know, it's got to move beyond that. And then they say, the wall, the dreamers. And as long as those are going back and forth that way, that's a way to disunite the people and to ensure the continuation of the system, and which in this, right now, at this minute more than ever before, is based very specifically upon corporate rule. That's the name of the game of politics today. So, that's what we have to get to the bottom of, and get to a more united place from the grassroots.
Elliot, you had something else to say?
Well, I mean, maybe we need a third Continental Congress or a new Committees of Correspondence. You know, we need more effective change. We just don't have it. Things have been downhill, since the mid-60s, when progressives had all three branches of government, and maybe it's like being an alcoholic. Maybe we have to hit absolute rock bottom about 5 years from now. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Ray, if you were a lead organizer in a revolutionary movement in 2018, to get us back on the proper track, do you have visions about what we would be doing and how we would be organizing, at what scales, with what kinds of goals?
Boy, that's a hard one. And unfortunately, we live in such a mass society where so much communication is basically impersonal, and the only people... See, what happened is back in the day, you would be talking directly to people, the two sides would be talking to each other. They were all... It was community organizing because there was a real local community. Now you basically hardly have a local community. You have like two split communities, since so much of community now is Facebook, and what, like 45% of the people get their news from Facebook. And we have basically people living within two echo chambers. And so the only thing that I can really recommend is that, well, two things. One is to do what Paul's doing and try to, at the grassroots, try to find the commonality between the progressives and the conservatives. Find that commonality. And Paul's convinced, and I agree with him, that it does exist. There is that commonality. The other thing I would suggest is don't fall prey to just yelling. You know,
no kidding.
That's going to get you anywhere. And every time as people get more and more pissed about Trump, you know, the Trump voters just love it. They just love to see the progressives writhing in all their stewing and all this, and they get such a kick out of it.
Ray, I think I want to just spend a minute talking about the community rights movement because you keep mentioning Paul's work. But for listeners who don't know, I'm a lead organizer and educator nationally in the community rights movement, which is a movement that started in 1999 and has spread slowly across the country, local by local. Towns, cities, and counties are passing paradigm-shifting laws, ordinances that are locally, directly enforceable by the public that do three things. These local ordinances enshrine the inherent right of the local community to govern itself and to protect its health, safety, and welfare. Each ordinance bans a particular harmful but legal corporate activity or occasionally government activity. And it also strips that sector of corporations of all of their so-called constitutional rights, their free speech rights, their rights to trials, etc. And what is ending up happening is that 200 communities in 9 states have now passed these precedent-setting laws, some very conservative rural communities, some more progressive larger communities. And that's just the first phase of a movement to shift the culture so that progressives and conservatives can understand that we have the legal authority as the sovereign, as we the people, if we dare to exercise it, to start passing laws that we can enforce to protect our air and water and our food, etc., which are issues that progressives and conservatives generally agree on, and then to work our way up politically so that we start taking our authority back at the state level and in the state constitutions and ultimately in the federal constitutions, so that corporations are once again subordinated to we the people and government is required to serve us. And if you want more information, go to communityrights.us, communityrights.us.
Yeah, it's a really important, beautiful organization. And part of what goes on with that is that the corporations tend not to sue because it's just too embarrassing for them when the townships do pass their laws, basically, right?
Only 5% of the 200 communities have been sued, and I think we're going to see, as the movement is building, a higher and higher percentage being legally challenged, because we are becoming a threat to the corporate state. And at that point, we need to think seriously about what it looks like, again, for us to think of ourselves and act as we the people, as the sovereign people, and say, well, we've already passed the law, and if the courts are telling us we're not allowed to, are we going to abide by the courts in the same way that Ray is talking about what happened in Springfield and Worcester, Massachusetts in 1774? Do we allow the courts to overrule the people's sovereignty to protect our own health and welfare? And so that is really the revolutionary impulse that drives us back to what Ray is describing.
And Ray, what would you have to say there?
Yeah, just, take an example for there. It's a civil rights movement. I mean, there were people, it was literally civil disobedience, but of such overwhelming numbers that it prevailed.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So, Ray, do you have a website that you'd like people to go to?
Yeah, it's just Ray Raphael, and Raphael is R-A-P-H-A-E-L, like painter or the archangel or the ninja turtle, so rayraphael.com. And then you can, and I've got 20 books. The book that's most relevant, the two books that are most relevant to this discussion are the one called The First American Revolution, and the other one, more recent, I would suggest, is The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. And there you get the whole dynamic of this community-based movement that really propelled the revolution and propelled the country from the ground up. But all of the books, like The People's History of the American Revolution, I think people would like. That's totally everyday people with it, and in the face of war. And, the revolution was the start of the revolution was very kind of beautiful and
Ray,
glorious in the sense that it really was community-based.
Ray,
we're
almost out of time. Could you talk for just a couple of sentences about the curriculum work you're doing and how people can find it? And then we're going to be out of time.
Go to Consorce, C-O-N-S-O-U-R-C-E, It's also, or the Constitutional Sources Project, and then go to their lesson plans, and then under lesson plans, you scroll down there, and it's called Choosing to Make a Nation. And it's simulations. So if you're any teachers out there, these are amazing simulations where people become the Constitutional Convention, and they become the first Federal Congress implementing the Constitution, and they're giving a lot of context so that they're not just going to be making snap judgments based on their own opinions. They're actually going to be learning history, because you don't understand history unless you know what the options were at the time and why people, what the people chose to do, not to do.
Okay, so you've been listening here to historian Ray Raphael talking from Humboldt County, California, also with Paul Cienfuegos, founder of Community Rights U.S., and I'm Stephanie Potter here at the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Ray's expertise is in the stories of the common people during the founding of our country. Paul is the founding director, as I said, of the Community Rights U.S. Project. Thanks to Tammy Dean for her fine engineering, and thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Thank you, Ray.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'm sorry for rattling on, but
No, you're great.
Thank you all.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. In our top story today, Zhang Zhang and Hua Hua have become the first clone primates that use a technique that created Dolly the Sheep. The result of 79 attempts, the identical long-tailed macaws were born several weeks ago at a laboratory in China. Two other monkeys were initially cloned from a different type of adult cell, but failed to survive. Researcher Dr. Sun of the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Shanghai said, quote, "We tried several different methods, but only one worked. There was much failure before we found a way to successfully clone a monkey." And while scientists say genetically identical monkeys will be useful in researching human diseases, critics argue the ethics of bringing